Hi, and welcome to Populous Podcast, Drawing People Together. I'm Charlie Brooks, Global Director for Communications for Populous, and I'll be your host for Season 2. Drawing People Together is a podcast that brings you insights, expertise, and ideas from the people at the very forefront of global venue and event design. This episode covers an area in which Populous thrives, elite training facilities. Charlie Fordham is a principal and architect in our London office. He's worked on extensive stadium projects, including the London Olympic Stadium, now home to West Ham United. He's also been the lead for Populous in the company's ongoing work with Chelsea FC on their training centre just outside London. Braden Goodwin is an associate principal and architect in our Asia Pacific headquarters based in Brisbane. His work in the esports sector has also seen him design arenas and training facilities for clients like Fortress, and also the world's first elite training facility designed in the Fortnite metaverse for YouTuber and content creator Lachlan Power. And then Scott Gibson is an associate principal in our Americas HQ in Kansas City, an architect, sustainability expert, and interior designer of professional and collegiate sports facilities. He's previously led the design for the University of Nebraska's Go Big project and the University of Texas South End Zone football training facility. So welcome Braden, Charlie, and Scott, and thanks again for being with us today. We recently held an elite training summit down at our headquarters in Brisbane. We brought in people from all over the world who are looking at elite training, and some of the clients we work with as well. It seemed that one of the key learnings was this, that we live in, you know, a global world, and despite different sports and different clients and different geographies, there are some universal challenges. So Brain, I just wanted to talk to you about what you think those challenges and those implications are, whatever the sport, whatever the geography that people identified as part of that summit.
Yeah, thank you very much, Charlie. We had four topics that we kind of interrogated as part of the summit. That was because we sort of had a conversation with IMA and also with the guys in the Americas in terms of what they were seeing as some of the global sort of trends, women's facilities, para sport facilities, and also recovery. Whilst we all come with a slightly different lens in terms of what the different trends are, it always came about to this idea of, I guess, flexibility of the actual venue itself and this idea of sort of future-proofing.
And Scott, what was your client's view as they interacted with Populous people from different sports?
There's obviously a lot of interest and intrigue surrounding the data and analytics portion of elite training space right now. One of the challenges that come out of that is the fact that there might be an abundance of data, but implementing it or using it for success on the field is very challenging if you don't know what you're looking for. And some of the most important data is the simple data, making sure that you're capturing things like how many times a week guys are practicing versus what their gate is. And from a technology standpoint, everything continues to change. And so it's really about providing a space that can be adaptable, almost designing for the space to be changed.
Where you talk about, rather than designing bespoke, you can make things more adaptable. Is that a modular design approach? Or does that mean simply designing elite facilities that are adaptable across different sports or different genders within the same sport?
I think it could be either. There could be a scenario where a modular system would work better. Typically, we try to start with a very regimented grid because it's better for elite training. But there's definitely a scenario where we could look at something that's more modular and plug and play so that those components could be updated in the future.
And Charlie, bringing you in for a second, your work on Chelsea, they've got huge sort of data input, and that has implications on the physical space that they wanted to create for the team and for the football department within the team as well.
One of the first projects we actually undertook with them was a kind of resourcing a study, basically, to understand how their operation had grown over the last sort of 10 years or so. 5 years ago, when we started our work down at Cobham, I don't think there was an expectation that that data recording would grow in quite the same way as it has done recently.
And one of the factors you see is there's been a trend towards bringing their entire life into the training centre. You know, it's no longer a place you just go to train and then you go home, but they want the athletes there all the time. How does that work at Chelsea and how has that evolved at Chelsea?
The management team have a lot of very strong views always on how they want players in and around the training facility. I think there have been some managers who've been far stricter in terms of they want the players to eat, sleep, live football. And one of our first pieces of work down at Cobham actually was changeover of a manager who saw things completely the opposite way, actually. And he saw the training ground as almost as a place of work. Their recreation, their relaxation was completely up to them and was done completely off-site. And so one of the first pieces of work we actually did for the club was actually stripping out these sort of very small hotel rooms within the first team building. And ironically, actually converting that into a data room to, you know, probably start recording some of this data we were talking about.
Braden, you've also done a lot of work with the AFL. In your experience, how much are clients coming and saying, okay, we've got the funding, we've got the land, now tell us what we need, versus coming to you and saying, right, we have a very clear idea of what we want you to design to? Where does it sort of sit on that spectrum?
In Australia particularly, there's sort of been somewhat of an arms race over the last sort of 15 years. You know, every single club has just tried to get one up on each other. Probably one of the benefits working with Populous is that we do have a very rich database of global benchmarks, which we can kind of look at. What Charlie spoke about previously regarding the separation between work and rest was something that was very important to the Brisbane Lions. They'd made a very conscious decision to move out of the city and make it a place that you needed to go to. So they very much have separated all their players' lounge room facilities from the actual main sort of, you know, wet, sweat and grind areas. They wanted to be able to get the best out of their players, that when they're on, and when they're off, they're off.
So, Scott, it's interesting. Charlie and Braden both talked there about specific sport facilities, whether for AFL or for Premiership football. You're working with Vanderbilt on an absolute cross-sport proposition. You have a football training area and then an Olympic sports training area. Can you want to talk about how that works in terms of that multi-sport proposition?
Similar to what Braden's talked about, is how each different sport would use the facility, what their needs are as far as rest recovery, strength conditioning, performance, sports medicine. When a football player is coming off the field, we need to get them into a recovery modality within a certain amount of time. And that's a different time period for other sports as well. Making sure that each sport has access to that social, biological, psychological recovery space, but also making sure that each sport has their own privacy as well, can be very, very challenging.
For those who haven't spent time in the US around collegiate sport, who might not be aware of the scale of investment and the scope of collegiate sport, it's right up there in terms of performance with the top professional leagues of other sports that we've been talking about.
You're looking at the best of the best athletes that make up the US Olympic team. Each athlete across every sport is how are they going to recover and maintain their ability to perform. That's always where we start.
The key thing in this, from a sports organization point of view, is funding. And historically, your money was spent on the stadium and the playing facilities and the fan facilities, and it still has to be. But the level of investment now needed for a state-of-the-art training facility is significant. How does that work in terms of the willingness to allocate the funds to the right level of performance training?
I think it depends on the institution. You know, for Nebraska, they're looking to really do something different and push the envelope. With other schools, they have different mentalities and different mindsets. It's really important when we start to look at these facilities is to understand what their end goals are. And their end goal is usually on-field performance. And so some of those things, we can be really specific and very mindful of how we approach that from a allocation standpoint to make sure that we're creating a facility that is A, adaptable, and B, functions for them, but is also an appropriate investment and not something that they need to go back and renovate in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, it was interesting, Braden, you talked at the start about designing for longevity. You're creating something that has to be state of the art, but it has to be something that's going to stand up for, you know, 15, 20 years. How do you bring in that concept of longevity to see a training facility that will stand the test of time?
A lot of it's come from benchmark data. In Australia, we're a little bit different. Very rarely a private wealth that's paying for a number of the elite facilities. It's government money. We still need to balance out the expenditure which is going into high performance sporting perspective with what are the community benefits as well. A couple of the facilities more recently, we've actually been trying to future-proof doing it in a way that you can commercialize the actual venues. For instance, they may actually have a gym which is large enough for the program, but they'll also have a commercial gym on site. So if they do need to expand or they do need to bring academy sides, that is something that's not just sitting there forever and a day. It's something that can actually be monetized. Can obviously benefit the community at large.
Something similar happens at Chelsea actually as well. There's a school next door to their training ground. A lot of the school kids end up, you know, going to the academy, but also the opposite is true. A lot of the medical facilities are all shared within radius of both the school and training ground.
Yeah, so I guess it's designing an approach that is adaptable in terms of use from the elite level to community level and grassroots level, whilst maintaining, to the point you made, Scott, the privacy of the data and the performance. Scott, when you talk about the work you're doing and going back to the level Vanderbilt as one of the leading schools for Olympic track and field, for example, means they will have top-level Olympians training at that school. How do they strike a balance between their elite-level programs and the participant programs going down through the levels of the school?
The school treats all their athletes the same. It's all coming down to the investment that they're putting into this space. Typically, in the university level, you see a lot more investment in the revenue generating or the net revenue generation sport, predominantly football and basketball. But there are other avenues that drive the competition across the remainder of the sports. And typically, that is the U.S. Olympic team. Definitely a different model than we see across the rest of the world. Being able to support and train and bring up that talent and ensure that investment of that talent is top of mind for an elite institution like Vanderbilt.
And we have a whole future episode talking about sort of equitable design and what that means. But Charlie, one of the things you've looked at with Chelsea is they want a facility that's integrated for their men's team, their women's team, and their youth academy. And that has design implications as well. Is that specific differences in design, or is that just about equitable use of elite facilities?
I think it's really interesting. You know, there are clearly some aspects of the game and the performance which are completely comparable between the men's team and the women's team. The privacy that female players are after, we've done a lot more to control access into wet areas. Those slight nuances between two squads playing exactly the same game, just with biology.
And Braden, obviously the Brisbane Lions was designed to be a completely equitable men's and women's facility. Can you talk from a training perspective about the brief that led to that?
The Brisbane Lions were very much upfront that everything was 100% parity. So there's not a separate academy or anything like that where the men's and women's programs are. It's all within the one organization, all within the one department, one building. So how we arrange the actual change rooms around recovery spaces and hydrotherapy spaces basically allowed for there to be dual access between all of those particular facilities. But what we did do, because they are still semi-professional, we actually allocated the additional space rather than just using it for locker space. We provided wider spaces for getting ready. We also allocated another change room facility for male coaches that could be associated with that particular area. It was more about just reconceiving the space and allocating it and engaging appropriately with both of the separate squads and trying to tailor-make something that was appropriate for each of those respective squads.
So we've talked about, you know, elite level performance in professional sport, in collegiate sport in the States, and the training requirements for that. But of course, esports is, you know, arguably the fastest growing sports sector. And there's been a real switch between this idea of it being, you know, gamers, sedentary gamers sitting down to perform, and the actual performance and training needs that they have. Charlie, you know, you've worked on a couple of those sort of esports centers. What's been your experience of talking to the teams about what they need from a training perspective?
If you're a footballer, it's easy. You come off the pitch and I think a bit easier maybe to change your mindset. Whereas I think with gaming, it's so ubiquitous, you know, professionally and personally, you know, people can play it in any environment. So this aspect of switching off and that ability to separate the training side of things from the recovery side of things, that was a very strong piece that we've learned on some of the projects we've been doing in the UK and around the Middle East too.
Scott, just talking to that area of sort of future trends, what have you seen as kind of innovations in the space of elite training facilities, and what do you see as trends going forward that are going to become more and more prevalent?
E23, the summit in Australia this year, one of the key innovations that our client took away was how people are recovering. We look at recovery usually from a single dimensional, biological and psychological. Mental health has definitely been on the forefront of a lot of athletes' minds. And what the data is showing, the research is showing, is that there's actually a social arm to that as well. And so being really mindful of how we're anticipating and planning for that multidimensional recovery, the psychological, biological, and social. The other innovations that we're seeing beyond recovery and data and analytics, I think it's really driven by the client, which is the exciting part. We have some clients that come in and they're wanting to shift the paradigm and do something different and look at it from a different lens. And that's where I think Populous is so uniquely positioned, because we have so many experts across the globe and we can start to leverage that in a unique way and bring about innovation in sport, whether it's from a training and recovery standpoint or a performance standpoint, and how all of that fits together into something that is truly unique and really going to drive change. And we're seeing that in some instances at the moment. And I'm really excited to share them in the future.
And Charlie, I know you're talking to the paradigm shifting for one of the areas is the ability to create nonstop content. training ground content is so important to that. But again, you're trying to strike the balance between giving the media teams and the content teams access to the athletes and to the players and the teams with the need for privacy and sort of a tight working environment for the football team. Is that something that Chelsea have looked at and explored from your side?
Every department that sits below the playing team themselves, you know, has grown over the last few years. You know, the amount of media commitments the players have, you know, again, I'm sure that's reflected in the work that, you know, Scott, Braden, you guys are doing too. You know, the spaces that we're giving over to that increased tenfold, I'd say, probably over the 5-6 years we've been working down at Cobham. In a project we've looked at in Southwest London for a Premiership rugby team, we actually looked at almost the antithesis of trying to recreate a lot of these spaces at the training ground that are already in the stadium. That kind of interplay between an element of media space that's needed on a match day versus where that sits in relation to a training ground. That's been a very completely sort of different way of thinking, I suppose, in terms of trying to mesh these two typologies together, the training ground and the stadium.
The idea of being able to amalgamate the two right from the start of the design brief versus having to retrofit a kind of training next to the stadium and use of the same facilities, that's a very different brief.
Manchester City, for example, where they like the idea of this progression between the training ground and the stadium, you know, this sort of ethereal bridge that links you between the two. And there's this sort of spiritual journey you go on as you progress from being an academy player to being a first team player, for example. There's other ways of thinking about it too. Where you do your work, where you do your training and where you play on a match day, it's the same. There's this sense of home, even when you're training in an empty stadium, for example, versus, you know, going in there with 20, 30, 40, 60, 80,000 people cheering you on.
Well, I don't know if you'll have a spiritual bridge to talk about, Braden, but we'll give you the last word. Going back to the idea of innovations and future trends from the work that you've been doing.
With the progression of technology, I think the real challenge will be what we don't need to build. If you look at the example of, say, a GPS tracker 10, 15 years ago, it was, you know, an elite club maybe only had two because they were $30,000 each and you wore it on your backpack. And so it wasn't overly ergonomically sort of friendly. And now everything can basically sit on a mobile phone. Every single player's got a tracker. The reason I say this is more from a sustainability lens is, you know, how can we also design our venues to be more sustainable into the future? You know, if we can build less and rely on technology more and still get a better outcome, for me, I think that's what is going to drive me into the future in terms of understanding how we can get the best outcomes for our clients.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I think we're privileged to have the three of you as sort of thought leaders in the whole area of elite training. Listening to your examples of different sports across different geographies, different genders is very enlightening. So I want to say thanks very much to Charlie, to Scott and to Braden for their participation. And thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you for podcast season 2, episode 2. Thanks very much.